Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the copy of the Bible, believed to be the most perfect ever written, survive 1,000 years of storage, theft, ransom, fire, and political upheavals, only to have 40% of its pages disappear sometime in the 20th century? Although less familiar to many lay people than the Dead Sea Scrolls, centuries of scholars and religious leaders have revered the Aleppo Codex as the most authoritative source copy of the Hebrew Bible in existence, ransoming it back to Jewish owners after a theft during the Crusades, protecting it from the elements and political upheavals for hundreds of years, and finally smuggling it into the newly established state of Israel after many experts had feared it destroyed by anti-Semitic rioters in Syria. But while the book escaped the flame, it is no longer entirely intact. And as my guest today has learned, its story is vastly more complicated than official accounts would suggest. Mati Friedman is a reporter for the Times of Israel and a former Associated Press correspondent. His new book is The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. Mati, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
You had never even heard of the Aleppo Codex until you found it in a Jerusalem museum 4 summers ago. Tell us about that day.
It was the summer of 2008, and I was a correspondent for the Associated Press, and I was looking for any excuse not to cover what I was covering 90% of the time, which was this endless and intractable and circular conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. So I got into covering biblical archaeology, and I was at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem in the building where the Dead Sea Scrolls are held. It's called the Shrine of the Book. On the top floor is the gallery where the famous Dead Sea Scrolls, the Scrolls of Qumran, are held, and that gallery was full of people, the tourists and visitors. I walked down a flight of stairs into basically the basement, a kind of dark subterranean gallery, and in that gallery I encountered another manuscript, and I understood from the labels that this was Judaism's most important manuscript and one of the most important books on earth, but I had never heard of it, and that was the Aleppo Codex.
And although it is widely considered among the most important biblical documents in existence, it doesn't necessarily look at first glance like anything special.
That's right. That was one of the things I liked about it. It's a book, as I write in my book, it doesn't beg for your attention. It's above that. There are no pictures. There's no gold leaf. There are no beautiful illuminations. There's no fancy binding. All it is text. It's page after page and column after column and line after line of very meticulous handwritten Hebrew letters. That's all it is, and I like that about it.
And it turns out to be written in the same hand throughout, which is a big deal.
Yes, the scribe who wrote it in its original incarnation had 500 parchment pages, and it looks like it could have been run off on a laser printer. The scribe, whose name we know, it was a scribe named Shlomo ben Boya'a, who lived in Tiberias, which is a city on the banks of the Sea of Galilee, and he lived there almost 1,100 years ago. And he's the scribe who is behind most of the writing of the Codex, all of the text in the Codex, and he was a professional. There's no doubt about it.
So, Mati, what makes it so different from other ancient copies of the Bible, and what convinces scholars and has for 1,000 years that this one is the most accurate?
Well, to answer that question, we have to go back about 900 years before the Codex was written, in around 930 AD, to the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD by Roman legions. Until that time, Jews had lived together in the same country in the land of Israel, and they spoke the same language, and they were bound by geography and by political leaders. And after the destruction of the temple, the exile begins, and Jewish communities begin to be scattered across the world, and eventually they're in Casablanca and Baghdad and Krakow and Moscow and London and New York, and they're growing farther and farther away from their homeland in Judea, and they have to somehow be held together, which has never been done successfully before. And the revolutionary idea that emerges is that a people can be held together by the written word. They can be held together by a book that they will all read. And for that to work, that book is the Hebrew Bible, of course, and for that to work, they have to be reading precisely the same book, because even minute differences in the text could lead to a splintering of the faith. There's a process of centuries during which the books of the Bible are chosen and the text is redacted and edited. The final stage, it takes place in Tiberias on the banks of the Sea of Galilee, the city I mentioned before. It lasts several centuries, and in that process, they arrive at the perfect text of the Bible, they invent vowel symbols. Hebrew, like Arabic, is written largely without vowels, so the vowels have to be added under and over the letters. They invent a system for writing that. They invent a system for writing the melody to which the text needs to be chanted, which also serves as punctuation, which is crucial. That process ends with the writing of the Aleppo Codex. The scattered people needed a perfect text. They needed an agreed-upon authoritative version of the book that was holding them together, and that was the Aleppo Codex, and that's why it's so important.
And inserting those vowels was a big deal also because there are certain words that could sort of go either way depending on what you put in between those consonants.
Absolutely. Take the word in English, the word HT. That's how it would appear in the Hebrew Bible. Is that word hat? Is it hot? Is it hit? Is it hate? Is it heat? It could be any number of different words, and there are 300,000 words in the Hebrew Bible, and they're all written without vowels. So the potential for confusion is immense. You could conceivably interpret the same passage in a number of different ways, and when you're talking about religious texts that are subject to such intense interpretation, that could really lead to the faith splitting apart. So the perfection of the text is no small matter. It was a matter of life and death for the Jewish people who were scattered and bound basically by this one book.
How did the Jewish physician and scholar Maimonides use the Aleppo Codex as a sort of source document in his work?
Right. The book, after it's written in Tiberias, ends up in Jerusalem. As you mentioned, it's stolen by the Crusaders when they arrive in the First Crusade, and it's ransomed by the Jews of Cairo. And in the 12th century, it ends up on the desk of Moses Maimonides, who is a famous Jewish philosopher, and he's a physician in the court of Saladin, and he's a famous scholar of Jewish law, and he's considered one of the great, certainly Jewish minds of the last several millennia, but he's one of the great philosophers of Western culture, I guess you would say, of world culture. And he, when he writes his most famous work of Jewish law, he's using this codex, and he writes it explicitly in his book. When he himself wrote a Torah scroll, a scroll of the Torah, he based it on this codex, which had arrived from Jerusalem before he was born. That, because of Maimonides' importance, because he is so respected, his stamp of approval turned this codex into the authoritative version of the Bible, and that's an importance it has retained until this day.
And it's still used as, the version of the Bible there is still used in translations into other languages even today?
Any serious scientific edition of the Bible in Hebrew that is printed is based as much as is possible on the Aleppo Codex.
So we glossed very quickly over the whole theft during the Crusades and the ransom back, but that's really an interesting part of the ancient history of this. Can you go back and tell us that story?
Certainly. I mean, the Codex is really an amazing window onto a millennium of history. The text, after it's written, it ends up in Jerusalem. This is all happening under Islamic rule. This is the Islamic Empire is in its ascendance, and when it's written in Tiberias, Tiberias is under Islamic rule. And it ends up in Jerusalem, the walled city of Jerusalem, in the hands of a Jewish community there, and the Holy Land is controlled by an Islamic dynasty. The Crusaders, the first crusade arrives in 1099. Having kind of hacked their way across Europe and into the Middle East, and they finally make it to Jerusalem. What they're chiefly interested in is the Holy Sepulchre. They want to redeem the sepulchre from the hands of infidels in their eyes. And there's a terrible battle in Jerusalem. Interestingly, Crusader chroniclers tell us that the defenders of Jerusalem were Muslims and Jews, which I hadn't known until I encountered those accounts. The Crusaders storm into the city, and there's a massacre that takes place in the city. They take apparently several hundred Hebrew manuscripts, among many other things, because it was known that the Jews would pay to get their books back. And it's worth spending a second remembering what a book used to be. The books were objects of great value, and they often contained not knowledge that was irreplaceable. They were copied by hand, of course, and it often took years and years to copy a book. It's not like today when other copies exist. You know, if one copy gets lost, there's one in the Library of Congress or online. The books often existed in one copy, and that was the case with the Aleppo Codex, it existed in one single copy. Judaism's most important book existed only in the original. So the Jews of Cairo, which was the most wealthy and powerful Jewish community in the region at the time, raised money and sent an envoy to the Crusaders to redeem human captives and to redeem the holy books that had been taken by the Crusaders. And that's how it ended up in Cairo, which was home to a very old and very important Jewish community, and it stayed there for several centuries.
It's an interesting bit of foreshadowing that even that early theft of the Aleppo Codex had money at its heart.
That's right. It's one of the ironies, because this is a book that's the Bible, not just the Aleppo Codex. The Bible is designed to raise us above such things. It's supposed to kind of raise us into a realm where money is not important and physical things are not important, but it is a physical object that exists in the world of humans, and that is one of our weaknesses, and it's always been part of the story.
We're still working on that one.
Yes, we're still working on it. It's a work in progress.
So how did the Codex end up in the care of Syrian Jews in Aleppo, which is where it got the name by which we call it today?
That's right. I mean, the Aleppo Codex became the Aleppo Codex only when it was very, very old. One of Moses Maimonides' descendants, it was his great-grandson's grandson, left Cairo at a time of political upheaval there and traveled north to Aleppo in Syria, which was an important trading center and home to an ancient Jewish community. It was a Jewish community that had been there for several centuries by the time the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. So we're talking about a very, very old community. And he took a large part of Maimonides' library with him when he moved from Cairo to Aleppo, and in that library it was the Codex. And travelers who passed through Aleppo around this time and in the centuries that followed mention this great treasure that's held by the Jews of Aleppo. And this treasure is a book. And it is hidden in the great synagogue of Aleppo for 600 years. And it's rarely taken out of its safe. At a certain point, it stops being studied very often, and it becomes something like a religious icon. It becomes the symbol of the community. There are stories woven around the Codex in large part to protect it. And the main story that's told about the Codex is that if it ever leaves the synagogue, if anything ever happens to it, the community will be destroyed. And when I interviewed old people from Aleppo, who had left Aleppo, old Jewish people from Aleppo, they used to tell me that superstition, and they might chuckle about it because, of course, it is just a superstition. And then they would kind of point out thoughtfully that that actually happened. The manuscript leaves the synagogue and the community is destroyed. Today there are no Jews left in Aleppo.
Yeah, and the idea was that those who protected it would have protection from God, but those who violated it in some way would be cursed.
And that's right. There's a very interesting, basically a curse written in the Codex, and it says that, you know, you'll be blessed if you preserve it and you will be cursed if you steal it. And that's written in the pages of the Codex.
And this is where the story starts to get very mysterious. Unlike so many other ancient documents, you know, that we sort of know the provenance in modern times, the 20th century is where it's much harder to get the exact facts of what happened.
That's also one of the ironies of this story, because we can figure out more or less what happened to it, you know, over the past 1,000 years, and things get really murky about 1947. Hmm. In 1947, the United Nations has a vote on November 29th, and a very important vote in which they decide to partition the British mandate territory of Palestine into two states, one for Jews and one for Arabs.
Let me jump in here because we need to take a break, and I want to make sure you have time to tell this very important part of the story. My guest is Mati Friedman. He's a reporter for the Times of Israel and a former Associated Press correspondent. His new book is called The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Associated Press correspondent Mati Friedman. He's now a reporter for The Times of Israel and author of the new book, The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. If you've got a question or want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So you were telling us, Mati, of course, about the UN resolution that established the state of Israel. What happened after that?
So the UN votes on November 29th, 1947, to partition Palestine into two states, one for Jews and one for Arabs. And the Arab world erupts. And there are riots targeting local Jewish communities across the Arab world. And it should be mentioned, because it's history that has kind of been forgotten, that there were about 1 million Jews living in the world of Islam. In very old, very established communities that had been part of the local landscape for many, many centuries. In some cases, for longer than Islam had existed in Aleppo. The Jews had been there for about 1,000 years before the birth of Islam. In Aleppo, there's a riot the day after the vote, and a mob attacks Jewish stores and Jewish homes, and they burn 18 synagogues. And one of those synagogues was the Great Synagogue of Aleppo, which is where the manuscript was kept. And the book disappears. And rumors reach Israel, according to which the book has been burned in the fire in the synagogue. And a Bible scholar in Jerusalem writes a very striking obituary for the Aleppo Codex, and he publishes it in an Israeli newspaper in the middle of Israel's War of Independence. So actual people are dying, a lot of them. But the grief over the loss of this book was so strong that it was deemed worth a newspaper obituary, and that's really what it is. It's an obituary for this book. It turns out, however, that the report of its loss was actually a carefully engineered deception that was undertaken by the leaders of the Jewish community in Aleppo, who knew that the Syrian government was trying to get its hands on the manuscript. The book was known to be very, very valuable, and the government wanted it. And in order to throw them off the trail, they spread the lie that it had been burned in the fire, when in fact they spirited it out of the synagogue and hid it in a storeroom in one of the Aleppo bazaars for 10 years.
Hmm. Yeah, and so the idea was everybody would stop looking for it if they thought that it no longer existed.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You spoke earlier, Mati, about the idea that this diaspora of Jews all over the world were sort of unified by the common language of their religious texts. It stands to reason, then, that this newly established fledgling state of Israel would want to possess and control a lot of those texts to then reunite culturally all these people who were streaming into Israel from all over the world without much shared culture, much in common at all besides their faith.
That's right. And you have two things going on at the same time. You have an ingathering of the exiles, of human exiles who are scattered all over the place and who are streaming into the state of Israel in its first years. And you have an ingathering of books, because as these Jews come back to Israel from the four corners of the earth, they brought with them the religious texts that had enabled them to survive as Jews in the diaspora. And that's a very interesting story in itself. And thousands of manuscripts, some of them very ancient, reach Israel in those years. And the most important of them was the Aleppo Codex, but there are many, many others, because part of the idea was to reunite not only the Jewish people, but to reunite the cultural heritage of the Jews in one place. And for that reason, it was very important to the Israeli government and to certain figures in the Israeli government to obtain Judaism's most important manuscript, the Aleppo Codex.
And of course, depending on where they were arriving from, the Jews of the world who went to Israel were not necessarily in a position to stay in control of all of their things as they moved into Israel.
Right, right. And there's it's a very interesting and for the most part untold story. And one of the examples I discuss in the book is the example of the Jews of Yemen, who were airlifted en masse to Israel in 1949 and 1950. They hiked from their ancestral villages in the in the Yemeni interior to an absorption camp at Aden. And at Aden, they were loaded onto planes and flown to Israel. And they brought with them, they left a lot behind because they couldn't carry it all on their back, but they brought their books, and they were told to leave the books at the absorption camp and that they would be reunited with their books in Israel. And some of them were, and many, many of them were not, and the books were never seen again. And some of them popped up later in official collections in Israel, including the collection of the National Library in Jerusalem. Some popped up in private collections and in bookstores. That's an important backstory to understand the story of the Aleppo Codex, because there was a general thirst for books, and that's part of this story.
There's a thirst for books, and there is a booming market in antiquities, sacred or otherwise.
That is correct. That's a market I've dealt with in some of my other work as a reporter, where I report biblical archaeology, and part of that is the antiquities market, which is very big and very murky in Israel, of course, being a source of so many of the antiquities that the world finds so fascinating, anything related to biblical figures, if it's King David or if it's Jesus. And yes, there's a thriving black market in ancient manuscripts, as I discovered, and I kind of delved into that part of the story in an attempt to follow a few clues as to where certain pages of the Aleppo Codex might be held. And I discovered a very, very interesting and very murky world.
Well, let's step back here for a moment and talk about the official story as to how the Codex found its way to Jerusalem and the condition it was in when it arrived.
The official story, which is the story that I knew when I wrote my first news story about the Codex in 2008, was that the Aleppo rabbis understood that their community was dying in the 1950s. And they finally decided that this book that could never be moved had to be moved. And in 1957, they gave it to an Aleppo Jew who had a rare exit visa. Jews were not allowed to leave Syria legally, but he had a very rare permit. And they decided to take advantage of that opportunity. And they bring the Codex out of its hiding place, and they gave it to this man who hid it in his washing machine and smuggled it across the border into Turkey and from there to Israel, where the rabbis instructed him to give it to the president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi. Now, Ben Tzvi was also a scholar, and he founded an institute that is, to this day, the custodian of the manuscript. It's called the Ben Tzvi Institute. That's the official story. That story is false, as I found, and the real story is far, far more interesting and, of course, a lot dirtier than that.
What was your first clue that the official story was not true?
The first sign that I had that all was not as I thought came after the publication of my first article about the Codex in the summer of 2008, when I started digging deeper with the idea that I would write something longer about the manuscript, and I expected people to be very happy that I was calling and asking questions. No one's really done anything with this manuscript in many, many years, and I thought that they would be happy to revive interest in it, and people just didn't want to talk to me. If it was academics and Jews from Aleppo and other people connected to the story, I couldn't get anywhere. It was very, very strange, and after a few weeks or months of this, I understood that there was some subterranean story here that was being concealed, and of course then my reporter's sense was turned on, and I couldn't resist, and then I spent several years trying to piece the story together, and that's the investigation that was published this month in the Aleppo Codex.
So what did you learn about the motivations that the rabbis in Aleppo might have had or not have had to send that book to Jerusalem in the first place?
So, right, exactly. That's an excellent question. They had a very good reason to send the book to Jerusalem, which was that they understood that this ancient Jewish community of Aleppo, which was at least 2,000 years old, was not going to last much longer, and they had to get their most precious spiritual possession out. They decided that the place for it to be was Israel. In the official version, as I mentioned, the rabbi's instructions were to give the manuscript to the president of Israel, effectively making it the property of the state of Israel, which it is today. And that's a very neat story because it is Judaism's most important manuscript after all, and the president of the state of Israel, there's kind of a neat symmetry to that story. But to anyone who's familiar with the Aleppo Jews and their relationship with that manuscript, with the Aleppo Codex, it sounds funny. This was their community's icon. It was their symbol. It was their most valuable spiritual possession. There had been attempts to buy it from them for enormous sums of money. There had been an attempt in 1943 by Ben Tzvi, who was not yet the president of Israel, he was then a scholar. He made an attempt in 1943 at the height of the Second World War to send an envoy to Aleppo and convince the Aleppo rabbis to give up the book. And they said no. And he sent another envoy with a request to photograph the book. And they said no. And in the end, they sent an envoy who was allowed to spend a few hours with the book over a period of several days. That was it. So there had been attempts to win the book away from the Aleppo community in the past, and they had never worked. So the idea that they would willingly cede the book to the Israeli government is a bit strange. And in fact, the documentary record makes clear that that is not what happened. The book arrives in Israel and became the focal point for a very interesting legal battle. There was a trial over ownership of the codex that lasted 4 years, and the transcripts of the trial have basically been kept secret, and they've never been published until now. And the trial is fascinating. It's about a technical question on the surface, which is, what was this courier, the guy with the washing machine, what was he told to do with the codex when he arrived in Israel? But in fact, it's about who owns history. The state of Israel believed that as the Jewish state, it was the incarnation of Jewish history and the representative of the Jewish people, and it was the rightful owner of Judaism's greatest book. And the Jews of Aleppo, who had guarded the book for 600 years, did not see it that way. They had not subsumed themselves into that narrative, and they thought the book was theirs. And the question plays itself out in court in a very, very interesting way.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because it's also about sort of control of quite literally the hearts and minds of a people, you know, and whether or not those can only be expressed, you know, through Zionist actions and impulses, or whether there are other ways to be a Jew in the world.
That is what the trial is about. That's exactly what the trial is about. And possession of this book, it is never made explicit, but it's pretty clear that possession of the book would bestow legitimacy upon the state of Israel as the curator of the great treasures of the Jewish diaspora. And that was something that the state was very interested in. But yes, not all Jews had accepted that at the time as their narrative. And certainly the Jews of Aleppo were, for the most part, not Zionists. And many of them did not go to Israel or did not stay in Israel. And many of them continued to America, where they proceeded to set up thriving, very, very successful communities in North America and in South America as well. So it was a clash of two narratives, and it's a very, very interesting trial.
So we mentioned in the introduction these missing pages of the Aleppo Codex, which, by the way, is also called the Crown. Talk about this. What do we know? What can we say for certain about the condition of the book before 1947, before those riots in Aleppo?
That ends up being a more complicated question than it would seem, and that also came as a surprise to me, because I imagined that someone had the answer to that question. The book was whole in 1943, when the scholar that I mentioned traveled to Aleppo to see it. The official version of the story, as regards to the missing pages, is that the manuscript was damaged in the riot in 1947, the riot that erupted after the UN vote. And for many years, it was believed that the missing pages were burned. The manuscript has kind of strange-looking marks on the bottom outer corner of each page. It's a kind of brownish-purplish mark. And it was believed for many, many years that those were burn marks, and that the manuscript had been singed in the fire, and that part of it had been eaten by the fire. And that was a kind of neat answer to that mystery, because then you don't have to check. You don't have to look into it any further. The pages were simply burned. In the 1980s, the manuscript is moved to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem for restoration, and a manuscript expert ran a battery of tests on the manuscript in cooperation with a microbiologist, and actually scientists in Albany, New York were also involved, and they run tests on these strange burn marks on the corner of the manuscript, and they send the results back to the lab at the Israel Museum, and the manuscript expert who I interviewed told me that he literally leapt out of his chair when the results came back, because the results showed very clearly that the mark was fungus. It wasn't a burn mark at all, and in fact, there was no sign whatsoever that the manuscript had been burned in 1947. And if it hadn't been burned, then where were the pages? And the question then is revived where are the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex? And there's a lot of interesting information I found that was kind of waiting for someone to come around snooping.
So not only where are they, but who took them?
That's right. Where are they now, and under what circumstances did they disappear? The official story that was in circulation at the time that I wrote my first article about it was that the pages had gone missing around the time of the fire, if not in the fire, because the fire theory had already been disproven. Then they were taken by Aleppo Jews who came to the synagogue immediately after the riot and took pages as souvenirs, pages or larger sections of the manuscript. And the reason that that theory was current was because two of the missing pieces have actually surfaced. And they surfaced in the 1980s, and they both surfaced in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, New York. And they were held, both of them, by Jews from Aleppo who had picked them up in the synagogue and had then emigrated to America. And they kept them as good luck charms. One was a page from the Book of Chronicles, a full page, and one was a torn fragment from the Book of Exodus that was laminated and kept in the wallet of an old guy from Aleppo named Sam Sabag, who kept it as a good luck charm and believed that it helped him survive open-heart surgery. And those pages were thought to indicate what had happened to the rest of the pages. But in fact, that's not the case. And the documentary record and witness testimony indicate quite clearly that that's not what happened to the missing pages or to the bulk of the missing pages.
The thought of anybody, even out of misunderstanding for what this was and the value of it, the thought of anybody laminating this thing must just absolutely make historians just cringe to the point of nausea almost.
Right. Manuscript, exactly. People who care about manuscripts and think these things are important cringe. I, as a journalist, I kind of smile because that's so amazing that people would do that. It's so colorful, and it shows, you know, of course, I wish that people had not damaged the manuscript. It's such an amazing illustration of the importance of that manuscript to the Jews of Aleppo. It had always protected their community. And once the community had been scattered and once the manuscript had been scattered, then its pieces continued to protect individual members of the community. And that's quite amazing.
The story is not over yet. We'll get more of it in just a moment with Mati Friedman, who's a reporter for The Times of Israel and author of the new book, The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, give us a call. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Or, of course, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mati Friedman. He was once a reporter for the Associated Press, now writing for the Times of Israel. He's got a new book out called The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mati, it seems impossible to accurately assess the spiritual and historical value of the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex, but what sort of monetary value do they hold?
It's very hard to pin down. The closest approximation that I can give is that a much less important manuscript was sold on auction. A Hebrew Bible manuscript was sold at auction several years back for $3 million. The Aleppo Codex is worth far, far more than that. And because each page is considered to have worth, the individual pages are also quite valuable. Pinning down an exact sum proved to be very, very difficult, but the manuscript itself is worth a lot of money.
What did you learn about the sort of person who might be willing to pay a lot of money to possess part of this?
It's the world of collectors, of old books is a fascinating and a difficult world to crack.
Yeah.
But the psychology of people who collect things turned out to be very interesting and unexpected. I think that for people who are, you know, like me or the average person, it's hard to understand why someone would want to own something that they can't display or that they can't sell. And that's the case with the missing pieces of the Aleppo Codex. The people who have these missing pieces are not supposed to have them, so they can't be openly sold and they can't be displayed in a museum. So why have them? And there are two main answers that I would give. One is that for many people, these pages have spiritual value. As we saw, people have kept them as good luck charms. The pages are believed to have power. And there's also the collector's motivation. There are people who collect things, there are people who collect biblical antiquities, and there are people who collect books. And the collector's mentality is one that loves to possess objects and to keep them, even if no one can see them. I interviewed one particularly interesting representative of that world who, it seems, is connected to the story of the Aleppo Codex and to its missing pages. And he is just someone who loves having these things, even if it's things that can't be shown.
You believe yourself to be one of the few living human beings on Earth who has seen a missing page of this thing.
Well, that story didn't turn out quite as I thought at first. The collector who I was mentioning earlier showed me a fragment of parchment that he claimed was part of the Aleppo Codex, and I got very excited because that would make me one of the few people in the world who'd ever seen one of the missing pages. However, and this is also in the book, a bona fide manuscript expert acting on my tip went to see the same collector in an attempt to see the same fragment to ascertain whether it was indeed part of the codex, and his conclusion was that it was not, and that this was kind of smoke and mirrors on the part of this very cagey, very, very interesting collector. What he was showing people, what he kept in a glass cabinet in his living room, was not actually a piece of the Aleppo Codex. And as someone told me afterward, that I was naive to believe that a piece of the Aleppo Codex would be something kept in a glass cabinet in the living room, that if he has it, it's not kept on public display and brought out to show visiting reporters.
Yeah, so it's not to say he doesn't have it.
Not at all to say he doesn't have it. And there are certainly indications that appear in the book that there is good reason to believe he might. And I recorded conversations with him that certainly give reason to believe that people looking for the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex might want to start with him.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have John on the line in Arlington. Hi, John.
Hello, Chris. Nice to talk to you. My question is, the relationship of the Aleppo Codex to the Leningrad Codex, especially in terms of, I thought that the Leningrad Codex, of course, is the basis for especially the BHS, the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensche, the critical edition of the Hebrew Bible. So anyway, just a little bit about that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much, John, for your question. The Leningrad Codex is another very, very important biblical manuscript that has been used for scientific editions of the Bible, largely because the Aleppo Codex has been inaccessible. The Leningrad Codex is about 80 years younger than the Aleppo Codex, and the Aleppo Codex was written under the stewardship of a very important textual scholar named Aharon ben Asher. He's considered one of the great textual scholars, and his stamp of quality is the most trustworthy stamp of quality on a manuscript. So the Aleppo Codex was actually written by him and by a scribe together during his lifetime and under his management. The Leningrad Codex, which was written much later after Ben Asher had died, is important because it is based on a manuscript written by the same Ben Asher. So it's a second-hand manuscript, which is still pretty good. But the Leningrad Codex is less accurate than the Aleppo Codex. And we're talking about very minute differences that don't make a big difference to the meaning of the text. But to Jews who require perfection in the biblical text, those minute mistakes in the Leningrad Codex, and there are several hundred of them, are very important, and they make the Aleppo Codex a far superior version of the Bible to the Leningrad Codex, which got its name not because it was written in Leningrad, but because it is currently held in Leningrad.
One sad irony about this whole project for you was that one of the places you were not able to travel for your research was to Aleppo itself.
That's right. I'm an Israeli citizen, and because a state of war exists between Israel and Syria, I could not travel there. The story, however, is not really in Aleppo anymore because all of the Jews of Aleppo have left.
Yeah.
And the people who I needed to speak to were not there. And when describing Aleppo in the 40s and 50s, I based my descriptions on long conversations with people who lived there then. And I hope that one day, it doesn't look particularly promising at the moment, I have to say, but I hope that one day I'll be able to visit Aleppo. Of course, I'd love to see the ancient synagogue, which still exists. It's locked up and empty, but the building is still there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Avi in Dallas. Hi, Avi.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm actually a sofer, a rabbinic scribe. I write Torah scrolls and repair and correct them, and I've done a significant amount of research on the connection between Maimonides and his writings in the Mishnah Torah and modern scribal practice and its origins in the Aleppo Codex, which, as the author sure knows, that Maimonides viewed it sometime in the 12th century, and it was disputed as to what codex he actually saw, and Gottstein proved in the 1960s that Maimonides had seen the Aleppo Codex. My question is, I've embarked very much on the same journey that the author has, and I ended up in the former Soviet Union, where I had a very renowned but secretive collector of manuscripts, books, and documents had hinted to me that he had a missing page of the Aleppo Codex. I was prepared to meet him when I received a call from the American consulate that the person who arranged the meetings was connected to the kidnapping of Americans in Ukraine, and that there was a likely chance that if I met with this gentleman, I might not make it back.
So I
had to cancel the meeting. But I'm wondering if you came across any evidence that any of these items might be in the former Soviet Union, and also if you did any research on the connection between Maimonides and the Codex, I'd be interested to hear more about it. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Avi. I would love, by the way, to listen in if the two of you were ever to get together for a cup of coffee, because I bet that would be a great conversation.
First, thank you for your question, Avi, and just to dwell on Avi's introduction. Avi is a scribe who writes Torah scrolls, among other religious texts. Torah scrolls are still written by hand in a way that is prescribed in very clear ritual terms. It can't be changed. A Torah scroll can't be printed on a printer or by a printing press. They're still written by hand. They're copied by hand, kind of a part of this textual tradition of which the Aleppo Codex is also a part. That's an amazing story about the missing page of the Aleppo Codex in the Soviet Union. I have not heard rumors about pages being in the Soviet Union. I've heard lots of other rumors, and anyone who looks into the story of the Codex hears rumors of pages here and there, and the rumors tend to end with someone who won't talk or someone who says they know something but won't tell you. That's one of the frustrating parts of investigating the story. But I think it's pretty clear that large sections of the Codex have been kept together and are circulating beyond individual pages that might be circulating in the Aleppo exile communities or elsewhere. And for Bible scholars and people interested in the text of the Hebrew Bible, those large sections are really the Holy Grail, although they'd be happy to find even a small fragment. Nothing has surfaced since the laminated fragment that I mentioned, which was found in 1986 in Brooklyn.
As to Avi mentioning that he was told it might not be a good idea for him to go because he might not return in one piece, you also got into some situations that felt quite dangerous.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent I was actually in physical danger, but certainly the world of antiquities, the black market in manuscripts, is very shady, and there are characters involved in it who you probably don't want to meet in a dark alley. And I'm sure Avi was wise not to go meet his contact, because even if it is a page of the Apocodex, it's probably not worth it. But one aspect of the story, which is a chapter in the book, is a murder that took place in Jerusalem in 1989, which was connected to a middleman who was purported to have been offering a large section of the Aleppo Codex for sale on the black market in the 1980s. And yes, there are dark doings connected with the trade in ancient manuscripts and in antiquities.
So the portion of the Codex that is intact is in this museum in Jerusalem. What sort of access do scholars have to it?
Today, the pages of the Codex have been scanned at a very high resolution and are available online. So anyone who is interested can access the pages of the Aleppo Codex. That was not the case for many years. One of the main justifications for obtaining the Codex from the Jews of Aleppo on the part of the Israeli government and the scholars of the State of Israel was that they had to be made accessible to everyone. But then, ironically, when it arrived in Israel, they did not allow anyone else to see it, and for many, many years they didn't publish a photograph of it. It arrived in Israel in 1957. A photograph copy was only published in 1976. So there's a tendency to hoard these kind of treasures, even though the Aleppo Codex was written to be copied as much as possible. That was the whole point of the manuscript, so that's one of the ironies of the story.
Is it reasonable to hope that within your lifetime the missing pages might be recovered and returned to the rest of the book?
Yes. I think those pages are out there. I think that it's very clear that they were not destroyed, certainly not all of them, and that there are large sections of the Aleppo Codex that are there and can be returned. I hope that the publication of this book kind of shakes the tree. Mm-hmm. We'll see if any interesting information falls out.
So as people may be able to deduce from your accent, you are a citizen of Israel, but not native born. You're from Canada. Has reporting on this story given you any insight into your adopted homeland that you might not have had barring this project?
Oh, certainly. I've learned a million things. I wouldn't even know where to start. One of the most interesting things that I learned, which I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't know about before, was the whole world of Jews in the Arab world. This manuscript is very much a product of that world, and I had never quite understood to what extent the Jewish world in the lands of Islam was old and native, and I had never really felt the loss of that world. We're very much aware in America of the Jewish world of Europe, which mm-hmm. is where most American Jews come from, but the Jewish world in the lands of Islam is far older than the Jewish world of Europe, and in many ways richer, and the existence of that world for so long and the unhappy end of that world is crucial to understanding the State of Israel as it exists today and understanding the modern Middle East.
Matti Friedman is a reporter for The Times of Israel and a former Associated Press correspondent. His new book is The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. Matti, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we haven't given too much away and people will still find their way to the book.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. If you want to make a comment, ask a question, or make a suggestion, you can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.